From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
China, before and after Election Day. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. TV commercials featuring Chinese music, pictorial characters, and gongs suggest that China has morphed from a communist threat to an economic menace. While Democrats claim free trade pushed American jobs to a foreign country, Republicans say green stimulus money is being used to buy Chinese products. Have both parties found the same scapegoat to blame for America's problems? Will policies change once the voting is over? Or have U.S. consumerism and profit-making combined to create an economic knot that can't easily be untied? On Reporter's Notebook later on, we'll update the story on Chile and its rescued miners. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. In the November election campaigns, both parties are blaming China in different ways for America's declining economy. Would new policies make a difference? Is it a time for a trade war? Or is the U.S. responsible for its own problems? On Reporter's Notebook, the mine where 33 people were trapped for 69 days has been shut down. What's next for the miners? What does the rescue say about Chile? First is news update. Millions took to the streets in France over this weekend, and a general strike is planned for tomorrow. Meantime, there was rioting today near schools in the suburbs of Paris. It's all about discontent with President Sarkozy. Peggy Hollinger is Paris bureau chief for the Financial Times. Peggy Hollinger, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I understand that things are pretty much shut down, at least as far as gasoline is concerned. There's a garbage strike. Tell us more.
Well, to be fair, I think one has to understand that this is a rather unusual strike in the sense that the public transport services still appear to be working. The trains are running, the buses are running, the power is still on. But what's happening here in these strikes is you're seeing that a group of rather more militant unions and militant industries and sectors are setting off on their own, sort of leading the protest against President Sarkozy and blockading fuel depots. And the refineries have been on strike for several days, for a couple of weeks now. And we also see a strike in the ports, which originally began as a protest against reform of France's uncompetitive ports. So there's a lot of things mixed up in this. And I think it's not at the stage yet where we can say that France is paralyzed, not by a very long way. There are some petrol stations which have run out of fuel. There are concerns about whether these blockades and protests will stop the trucks from coming in to the depots to getting the fuel to bring it to the petrol stations. But we're not yet at the stage where the country is paralyzed.
On Wednesday, the Senate is scheduled to vote on President Sarkozy's pension reforms. And I understand a general strike is planned for tomorrow. What do you think the impact of that will be?
Well, again, a couple of things. I think what you've seen, this has been a race against the clock, really, especially for the government. The government has announced its pension reform. It wants to increase the retirement age from 60 to 62 and the age at which you get full benefits from 65 to 67. And the way they've done this is they've accelerated the calendar. They've wanted to push this reform through very quickly. And there's a great deal of resentment over the speed at which this has been done and what the unions and a wider number of the general French public see as a lack of consultation. So there's a great amount of discontent over the manner in which this was done. There are a lot of amendments presented onto this bill, which has been put forward for a Senate vote, and it now looks like the vote won't happen on Wednesday.
Mm.
It probably will happen at the earliest on Thursday. But the government is determined that it should happen by the end of the week. So it's a race against the clock that can they contain these protests? Can they keep them from really turning violent ahead of that crucial Senate vote? Because once it's voted through the Senate, it's been voted through the lower house of Parliament, the House of the National Assembly, and then it's just a question of rubber stamping by the Parliament as a whole. So it would be very difficult for the unions to protest and to lead national strikes against something which has been democratically approved by Parliament, the elected officials. So it really is a race against the clock on both sides.
Complicated situation. What about the rioting near the schools in the suburbs?
Well, again, I mean, I would hesitate to use the word riot. I think there have been clashes. I think it is when the high school students came into this protest last week, there were a number of concerns voiced both on the union side and on the government side about the involvement of youth, because youth certainly always bring a rather unpredictable element into protests. And up till now, one of the interesting things about this protest is that the unions have known pretty much from the start that the government was not going to back down. Nonetheless, they have been trying to flex their muscles and show the wider French public that they count and that they can bring the government back to the negotiating table, at least on certain aspects. And the government has refused to do that. So what you have then is a wider discontent. You've brought the youth in, which means the unions can no longer control the movement. And the truck drivers have come in as well, and the truck drivers are also a rather more militant strain of union membership. And they, too, are beginning to blockade things. So the real question right now, the difficulty is that the protest risks running spiraling out of control of both the unions and the government because of these various militant elements. And what's really fueling this is a wider discontent with President Sarkozy, the way he manages the country, his approach, his autocratic approach to power, his rather brash style. There's also a great deal of anxiety here in France over unemployment and the impact of the crisis and the fact that the French economy is slow to get back to growth. So there's an awful lot wrapped up in these protests, which means it's much more difficult to predict.
Much more difficult to predict, but wonderfully laid out for us with a great deal of detail in a very short period of time by Peggy Hollinger, the Paris bureau chief. How much longer does Sarkozy have to serve in office?
Well, he faces election in 2012, but the real election campaign will probably start at the turn of the year here in 2011, and already you see various parties jockeying for position. So for Sarkozy, the really crucial element about this pension reform is that if he doesn't push it through, he alienates most of his voters. One of the remarkable things in the opinion polls is that most French people support these strikers. However, his own voters, by a very large majority, want him to stand firm. So if he wants to be reelected again from his own party, he has to stand firm.
Thanks to Peggy Hollinger in Paris for the Financial Times. In a moment, China, before and after the November elections on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. In this year's political campaigns, Democrats and Republicans are accusing each other of helping to cause America's economic decline. In the process, both parties are demonizing China. David Chen is monitoring TV commercials for The New York Times. And David, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to hear some of these commercials as we go along in our program today. But what have you found in general, and how widespread is this amongst both parties?
I started noticing this a couple of weeks ago, and it started primarily with a series of Democratic ads for candidates, particularly in the Midwest. And it seems that the Democrats are calculating that sort of a general economic anxiety over jobs sort of the future sort of dovetails with a broader and more long-term concern about outsourcing. In a lot of places, you know, the NAFTA and CAFTA and those kinds of things are still sort of an anathema to a lot of voters, and I think they've tried to tap into some of those fears.
Okay, let's hear one of the examples of the Democratic spots. This is an ad from the Pennsylvania Democrat. There's an open Senate seat in Pennsylvania. The Democrat Joe Sisak is targeting the Republican challenger Pat Toomey for taking a pro-Wall Street stance. Let's hear that spot.
Congressman Pat Toomey. He sided with Wall Street, voting for unfair trade deals with China. They made a fortune while Pennsylvania lost 90,000 jobs. But Toomey wants even more trade deals. In his book, Toomey admitted he doesn't care if American workers lose their jobs to cheap Chinese imports. Pat Toomey just doesn't get it.
I'm Joe Sestak, and I authorize this message because I'll never forget whose side I'm on.
Complete with gongs. Back to David Chan with the New York Times. Do you know whether or not Pat Toomey's book really says that he doesn't care if jobs go to China?
Well, I mean, it's more of a philosophical disagreement in terms of one's position on free trade. I mean, the Republicans, and they've been hitting back with some force as well, say that it is very, very difficult to kind of trace jobs when it comes to outsourcing because the world is such a complicated place, and a lot of Republicans are fervent supporters of free trade. What's interesting about the Sestak-Toomey campaign is that just the other day, Sestak released yet another commercial about China, in which the gongs were used again, and the last image was that of a crumbling fortune cookie, which is kind of ironic since the fortune cookie was actually invented in the United States. So in terms of, sort of images and stereotypes and other things, sometimes, it seems to be pushing the envelope a bit.
You could certainly say that safely, I think. Let's hear this ad to suggest how the Republicans are responding. This is from West Virginia Republican Elliot Spike Maynard against Democrat Nick Rahal, who is the congressman at the moment, has to do with stimulus dollars and what's happening to them.
I'm Spike Maynard, and I approve this message.
It's on our genes, even children's toys made in China. As part of the Obama-Pelosi team, Rahal voted for a bill that led to billions in tax breaks for foreign companies creating Chinese jobs. Rahal's vote helped foreign companies create Chinese jobs making windmills. With skyrocketing unemployment, only a politician who's been in Washington 34 years would vote to help foreign companies create Chinese jobs making windmills.
Okay, fortune cookies were invented here in the United States. So what about windmills coming from China, David Chen? How does that what's the logic behind that?
Well, I don't want to go into the tilting at windmills analogy, I suppose. But, that claim is as with the outsourcing claim in terms of jobs, a little dubious to kind of back up. It sort of stems in part from some from some reports earlier in the year, which were also propagated by Sarah Palin, that part of the stimulus bill, went to help some companies with tax breaks in setting up energy windmill energy operations in China. And in fact, the American Wind Energy Association says that that's not true. The Treasury Department says that that's not true. But again, it's sort of difficult to kind of trace all the different moving parts of a multinational corporation in terms of, what happens and why it happens. I think what's important to remember is that both sides are trying to gain an advantage when it comes to the loaded term corporate tax breaks. You recall it was mentioned in that ad, and the Democrats have tried to also hit back by accusing Republicans of being opposed to closing tax loopholes. So at the end of the day, it is still sort of a battle for who kind of makes the most sense in terms of trying to look out for the interests of their local constituents and closing tax loopholes.
Local constituents obviously will decide these elections around the country. But one of those ads sounded like it came from, as I remember, the Republican National Committee. So obviously they're distributing these over quite a large number of regions. Which ones in particular?
Well, many, many states. I mean, a lot of them in the Midwest. You see quite a few ads in Pennsylvania, not just with the Sestak-Toomey race, but the number of congressional races. You've seen it in Michigan quite a bit. There was just one, I think, a few days ago in the governor's race. I think it was targeting Rick Snyder, if I'm not mistaken. And you've seen it in Ohio, where it's come up a lot. There was one ad, which I mentioned in a story I did about this a week ago, which actually featured a picture of a dragon and actual Chinese characters for thank you in the ad itself in a hotly contested congressional race. It's also figured in the governor's race. Ted Strickland has tried to use that against John Kasich. But you see it in California as well. Barbara Boxer is trying to use that against Carly Fiorina, and and HP, you know, with their operations in China. And certainly the Democrats that I've talked to say that they feel that they have, you know, some, they feel that this holds some promise because they've done some polling. They also sort of did a little test run in Pennsylvania back in the spring in the race to fill John Murtha's seat, and that was an issue that they said resonated a bit. So they are hopeful that they can, you know, pick up some votes or at least not lose as many seats this time around.
Okay, David Chen, again, political reporter for the New York Times. We'll hear a couple of more ads as we go along today. First, I want to introduce Harold Meyerson. He's a columnist for the Washington Post, editor-at-large for the American Prospect magazine, something of an expert on the labor movement in the United States. Harold Meyerson, always good to have you on our program.
Always good to be here, Warren.
What about this, particularly from the Democratic standpoint? Is it more than just the simplifications and gongs and Chinese characters that we've heard so far?
Well, there is. And, you know, the Wall Street Journal recently ran a front page story noting with some surprise, and I'm surprised that they were surprised, that the American public rejects corporate free trade, that somewhere upwards of 90% of Americans are fearful of the effects of offshoring jobs in general, and rising numbers fearful of offshoring their own jobs in particular. So this is tapping into something very deep, which is the realization that as the global economy grows, America's lead over other nations is declining. That's on the broadest level. And for most Americans, other than the wealthiest Americans, the period of globalization coincides with a period of income stagnation or worse. So people are looking at this, and they're apprehensive, actually left, right, and center.
Should the United States take some sort of action to deal not only with this constituent unhappiness, but also with China?
Well, if we don't take some action generally about industrial policy and trade, we're going to lose a share of our gross domestic product every year. We're going to lose a share of our wealth. Because we buy more than we send overseas, and for all the apostles of free trade have said, they haven't explained why our pursuing a free trade policy, while other countries like China follow a mercantilist policy, which is based on advantaging their own companies to bolster their own national income and clout. Why that isn't the economic equivalent of a policy of unilateral surrender, and. Generally, a lot of attention has been focused on the value of Chinese currency, but there are other ways that that this can be addressed by the American government as well. For instance, the government has just brought to the WTO a complaint that the Chinese government subsidizes its alternative energy sector, the folks in China who do make wind turbines. For export, which is against WTO regulations, and has placed American wind manufacturers at a real disadvantage. This is a complaint that began with the steelworkers, who produced a 6,000-page document detailing these allegations, and the government agreed last Friday to bring this complaint to the WTO. So there are all kinds of things the government could do, and I hope even when people disagree on trade policy, they can at least agree that this country needs what pretty much every other country in the world has, which is some kind of concerted policy to foster American industries, which we have not had. And the reason the Midwest and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan are the epicenter of these kinds of ads is that this is the former factory belt, and the people who used to work in those factories either have no jobs or more likely have jobs that pay less. America's transition from an industrial to a post-industrial nation has not been a smooth one for most Americans who've experienced it.
Harold Meyerson again with the Washington Post and the American Prospect. Zachary Karabell is the president of River Twice Research. He's author most recently of Sustainable Excellence, The Future of Business in the 21st Century. He's also author of Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends Upon It. Zachary Karabell, good to have you on our program.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Harold Meyerson. Is it time for the United States to take some effort, or does the title of your work suggest that that would be futile?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's certainly true that my subtitle is leading in the direction of disagreeing with some of what Harold has talked about, and it's not out of denial of the degree to which the current global economy and the place of the United States within it is both highly disruptive of aspects of the domestic American economy and disadvantageous to tens of millions of Americans. But it's also true that we are at the latest iteration of a system that has been evolving for decades that we cannot, for better or, and perhaps for worse, simply decide now that we don't like the unintended and negative consequences of, so we're going to either try to reverse what's been done or create barriers to flows of goods, capital, and services that go both ways, that are deeply embedded in our current economic system, and that we can't just cut off without doing ourselves extraordinary harm and even further dislocations.
What kind of harm?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not just that our supply chains are global. They're partly in China, but they're also in Taiwan and Singapore and elsewhere. The cost of our goods is dependent upon those supply chains. So there's no such thing as retaliate against China without raising the cost of goods domestically. And those two things are intimately linked. Now, I can agree that we should have much better policies about invigorating both innovation and industry in our own domestic economy. But that is a separate discussion from looking abroad, particularly in this case toward China, to blame China. And one quick thing on this, it's a bit of a canard that industrial production in the United States has been hollowed out. In sheer dollar terms, in 2009, at the worst of the recession, the gross value of U.S. production in the United States was $3 trillion, which was greater than it was in either 1990 or 1980, in equivalent dollar terms. We have highly productive manufacturing, but unfortunately, it's highly technologically productive and requires fewer bodies, and that's as much a product of information technology revolutions of the past 20 years as it is from any kind of globalization of the workforce.
So is that one of the reasons then for unemployment?
It is definitely one of the reasons for unemployment, but so too is the collapse of the housing market. I mean, a good degree of the jobs that have been lost in the past 3 years have been in the construction industry and in the finance, the housing-related finance industry, and then the retail-related to the housing industry. So that is yet an additional factor to the erosion of manufacturing jobs, which has been going on almost unbroken since the mid-1970s. And then you add to that this job market that also went up with the housing bubble in related industries.
Okay, Zachary Carabel, once again, president of River Twice Research. We'll come back and continue this conversation after we take a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook, what does the rescue of trapped miners say about Chile? Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point to talk about China as the subject of campaign commercials by both political parties and, of course, as a trading partner or a trading enemy, however you choose to think of it, with the United States. Just to clarify, or rather drive home the point about China being used in spots. Here's an ad from an Indiana Republican, Todd Young, against Representative Barron Hill, the Democrat in Indiana's 9th congressional district. Listen to this.
Is Barron Hill running for Congress in Indiana or China? Barron Hill supported the $800 billion failed stimulus package that created renewable energy jobs in China. His big spending programs will force us to keep borrowing money from, you guessed it, China. So Hill's creating massive new debt here while he created renewable energy jobs over there. Barron Hill, for Indiana or China? We fired him once. The National Republican Congressional Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Let me go back to Harold Meyerson, columnist for The Washington Post and the editor-at-large for The American Prospect. What about that claim that it was the stimulus, in fact, that helped the Chinese to build the windmills, which you said they really are building?
Well, this, I think, originated in a Wall Street Journal story that noted that the Department of Energy was distributing stimulus money to wind farms, and that there was a wind farm in Texas which would require 30 workers to operate it, but that the turbines were actually built in China, because one of the problems of the American economy is in our zeal to offshore. There's a lot of high-tech stuff that we don't make here, lithium-ion batteries for electric cars, many high-end products. It's not just low-end products that we are no longer making. We have abandoned the market in a number of high-end products as well, often to countries like China, which subsidize their industries. Now, one of the things that most fascinates me is that the Steelworker Union here in the United States a few weeks ago announced a deal with a Chinese wind power manufacturer based in China, actually, to that they would build and open a wind turbine factory here in the States, I think actually in Nevada. So it's almost as if we've reduced the Steelworkers Union, or elevated the Steelworkers Union, to the position of venture capitalists. They go out and deal with a Chinese company that knows that its industry is under tremendous political pressure in the United States, and says, look, you know, take off some of the heat, win some goodwill, build a wind turbine factory here. But the fact is that there was an indirect part of the stimulus in boosting the consumption of alternative energy that helps alternative energy manufacturers everywhere, and by and large, everywhere usually means everywhere but here.
Okay. Here in California, as mentioned before, Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer has been targeting her Republican challenger, Carly Fiorina, whose voice will be heard on this commercial, claiming that Fiorina supports the outsourcing of jobs to China and did it herself as the head of Hewlett-Packard.
Carly Fiorina, as CEO, she laid off 30,000 workers and shipped jobs to China.
China, India, Russia, Poland. I know precisely why those jobs go.
Because Fiorina shipped them there. To Shanghai instead of San Jose. Bangalore instead of Burbank. Proudly stamping her products made in China. 30,000 workers gone, while Fiorina took $100 million for herself. Carly Fiorina, outsourcing jobs out for herself.
I'm Barbara Boxer, and I approve this message.
Zachary Carabel, back to you with the president of River Twice Resource. Does, in fact, Carly Fiorina, whose voice is heard on there, have a point that, in fact, jobs are going to go elsewhere?
Yeah, but jobs have been going elsewhere for the past 35 years. And in the 1970s, they were going to Japan and Taiwan. In the 1990s, because of NAFTA, they were going to Mexico, and now they're going to China. You know, that's not a statement of either defense or praise. It's simply a factual reality that the trend of the past 35 years has been for manufacturing to go to somewhat lower cost parts of the global food chain. And as I said before, it's a myth that U.S. manufacturing has, in terms of its productivity, been hollowed out. It is more productive and more generating more, you know, revenue than it ever has before. It just doesn't employ nearly as many bodies. And if we were to suddenly make much of what is made elsewhere in the world, we would be faced with a legitimate issue of how do we make things at the lower end of the manufacturing scale that we are capable of keeping at the lower end of the price scale. And you know, if incomes are stagnant in the United States, which on aggregate they have been, that becomes a completely untenable economic, not to mention political reality. You know, this is an issue of there has been huge income disparities opened up in the United States, which means that much of the trends of these past years have been highly beneficial to a select group of Americans and companies and not nearly as beneficial to a lot of labor. It's simply not true that this globalization of both the supply chain and products being made elsewhere is on average, you know, kind of disadvantaging the United States per se. I mean, we're also a very affluent country. It's difficult to grow as quickly, you know, once you've reached a certain level of affluence, which is something Western Europe and Japan are facing as well. But again, I think the externalizing of these issues, while it makes total sense in a campaign because it's easy and cheap, does us almost nothing to solve issues that we have to deal with.
Michael Hirsch is chief correspondent of the National Journal. He's author of Capital Offense, How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. Michael Hirsch, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
As the political parties beat each other up over China and whether or not one or the other of them is doing more good for China than it is for the United States, should they be looking at themselves?
Oh, very much so. The only surprise about this to me is that it has taken as long as it has into this recession or post-recession, which I guess is where we are now, to begin attacking China. You know, it's kind of a latter-day iteration of what happened 20 years ago or so with the Japan bashing over jobs. Of course, the crisis is much larger now, but so is the target, China, in terms of its power in the global economy and its power vis-a-vis the United States. So I don't think it's, it's not surprising that politicians are doing this. I tend to agree with Zachary that a lot of it is misdirected, and frankly, I don't think it's going to amount to a lot. I think what we've seen, particularly in recent weeks, is that China is rather, more nakedly exercising its economic power, particularly over currency depreciation issues, saying, look, we're going to give a little, but we're not going to give a lot, certainly not as much as you want.
So is China just being scapegoated then, do you think, for political purposes by both parties?
It's being scapegoated. I mean, there's no question that China bears a lot of responsibility here, particularly on the currency issue, and also in flouting, I think, a lot of WTO rules in terms of export subsidies, the subject of this United Steelworkers complaint under Section 301 of the Trade Act to investigate China's state support for clean energy exports. But I don't think that's going to go very far. The Obama administration was authorized in a rare, very bipartisan vote over recent years by Congress to institute tariffs, but I don't think that's really going to happen for the same reason as we don't declare China to be a currency manipulator. They're just too important to our economy. So I think you're going to hear a lot of hue and cry over this, but not much is going to result. In fact, the Chinese are now coming back and saying, well, look at your stimulus bill. It includes a lot of subsidies for clean energy, and doesn't that violate the WTO? WTO rules, by the way, are notoriously difficult to understand, so this case could go on for a while.
What has the White House response been to all of this?
Well, the White House has been increasingly upset over China's recalcitrance, particularly on currency, as has the Treasury Department. Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, has been discussing this with other G20 nations, there's been a lot of distress because China, has basically been thumbing its nose at these calls for a much more dramatic depreciation of its currency, up to 20%, which the Chinese government has said there's no way that's going to happen. In fact, a Chinese official said this for quite frankly for the Chinese recently, saying, look, we're not going to do it. It's going to disrupt our social stability. We are an export-driven economy, and we're simply not going to do it. So there aren't many tools that the Obama administration has, and I think the result of that is whereas they've kept an arm's length from Congress, because Congress tends to be more hawkish on these trade issues for political reasons, I think you're seeing a willingness by the Obama administration to encourage Congress in some of these efforts. And indeed, an administration official I talked to today, actually pointed to this this clean energy case, suggesting that that this was the way they wanted to go.
You said, though, that tariffs you don't think are going to happen. Why not?
Because the Senate usually stymies efforts. We saw a House vote in September authorizing the administration to do that. And again, administrations going back several, quite a number of administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have declined to start a trade war with the Chinese.
Harold Meyerson, back to you with the Washington Post and the American Prospect. Is there a difference between the way the Senate looks at this and the way that the House does?
Always. At a time when we think of the two rigid categories in American political life being the two parties, in fact, there has been a real rift between the House and the Senate going back 15, 20 years on their approach to trade. It's always been harder to get free trade legislation through the House than the Senate. And the vote recently taken in the House on the currency issue is about the only bipartisan vote in a significant issue you can find in the House. I think House members, whatever their party, are closer to their constituents who are having, you know, a really tough time economically. In the Senate, I think the individual senators are closer to Wall Street or closer to CEOs, and free trade legislation and opposition to tariffs has always had an easier time in the Senate. So this may be the one rift in Washington that isn't strictly partisan.
Let me go back to David Chen, our first guest, political reporter for the New York Times, who's following these commercials as an assignment for his paper. Do they seem to be succeeding? You indicated that there were new ones coming up this week. Do both parties think that whatever they're trying to accomplish, that beating up on China is successful with the voters?
They must feel that it's working to some degree because they keep on producing new ads. I mean, my story mentioned that there were 29 different candidates who had released ads in the last couple of weeks. And since that time, about a week ago, I think maybe another dozen or so have followed suit. So clearly they must be calculating that there's something to be gained. The other thing is that if you listen closely to the ads, on both sides, that a lot of the key talking points are sort of contained in a lot of the messaging. For the Republicans, for example, they talk about the stimulus, they talk about debt, they talk about jobs. These are things that have been staples in every single ad that Republicans have cut across the country. The only thing that's missing, arguably, is the name of Nancy Pelosi. And on the other side, the Democrats, you know, are trying to talk about outsourcing as a key issue. They're trying to talk about corporate tax breaks, and some ads are trying to link Republican candidates to defending Wall Street, which of course has also been you know, sort of the bête noire of a lot of campaigns. So they do feel that they are succeeding in trying to get that message across. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that visually, the ads are quite striking as well. You know, whether it be sort of doors resembling you know, the entrance of the Forbidden City, or whether it be images of the Chinese flag, or in the ad with the candidate from Indiana, Todd Young, there is an image of clenched fists. Raised as if, you know, sort of they were workers from Maoist China or something like those. So those images reinforce sort of the concerns and the fears that a lot of constituents have about the issue. So I think you'll see these continue.
Back to Zachary Carabel. What do you think about the idea of the steelworkers making a deal with the U.S. steelworkers making a deal with a Chinese company to build windmills in Nevada?
Well, I mean, it's certainly an irony that it happens at the same time that the steel union is spearheading the complaints on the WTO against China, you know, illegally subsidizing their alternative power industry. So it's consistent, right, in that it's not that there's a complete resistance to the reality of China's economic emergence. And I suppose that's a bright spot. I mean, one of the unintended consequences of China's currency appreciating, which incidentally, separate from all these bills, it has been and was on the path of before the financial crisis of 2008, is that China's going to be looking for less expensive investment possibilities, many of which will be in the United States because their currency will be worth more and ours will be worth comparatively less. And you have to wonder whether or not the same reaction will greet China's direct investments in the United States that greeted Japan's direct investments in the United States in the late 1980s and 1990s. You know, it certainly would be a net benefit for the United States economy if some of those dollars that have essentially been sent to China as part of this whole trade process would come back to the United States, not just in the form of, you know, inexpensive treasury debt, but in the form of buying actual businesses. And I suppose it's a good sign that the steelworkers are embracing that possibility rather than xenophobically fighting it.
Harold Marson, should we change trade relations with China? Should we denormalize them, if that's a word?
Well, I mean, I agree with the sort of pragmatic cautions in this discussion that there's a limit to what we can do. And certainly we're not going to compete with the rest of the world, as Zachary said, on making cheap goods. I mean, it seems to me, though, that the question isn't so much the Chinese question as the German question. Germany is a high-wage, high-benefit economy that has maintained high-end manufacturing and leads the world in it. We haven't, and that's the course that we haven't taken. We've shifted instead to a more service-dominated economy, and while Zachary is right that the productivity of factories is one factor in the reduction of percentage of workers and the number of workers working in factories, I think the question is why haven't there been any sectors of American finance and American corporations that have taken it upon themselves to build a profitable high-end manufacturing strategy here, as the Germans have done, and that they have a favorable balance of trade, and we have a notoriously unfavorable balance of trade. So there are a lot of roads not taken here, and a kind of war with China. I think there'll be skirmishes, and I think there should be skirmishes, but I think the larger issue is setting up the kind of industrial policy here that will enable us to make the kind of high-end goods that we need and that we're currently buying from Germany.
Michael Hirsch, in the meantime, aside from whatever it may be doing in the one campaign or another, what's the likely impact of all this xenophobia that David Chen described, playing on fears, bashing another country in the way that we have done from time to time in the past? And does that distract attention away from what the real helpful policies might be?
I think it does. I mean, if you look at the Japan case in the 1980s, the Japan bashing, ultimately it led the Japanese to do a lot more direct investment here, creating jobs. I mean, you'll notice people scarcely remember that the United Auto Workers was among the groups, the unions, most inveighing against Japan, while the Japanese started to build a huge number of plants here, along with the Koreans, providing jobs. And you know, we heard the last of that. This is a little different. I mean, the Chinese have had a much more aggressive trade support policy. So I don't think that the xenophobia is going to amount to much, except that I hope, you know, that it could lead ultimately to a more enlightened trade policy. I mean, I think, frankly, the United States ought to just be changing its tax code and export or at least industry support policies, you know, and say the heck with the WTO rules for the most part. Let's just go ahead and build up our industry and incentivize companies to invest here, particularly as, you know, David Chen points out, yes, there has been some depreciation of the dollar against the Chinese currency.
I mean, if they violate the WTO rules, we can do so too?
Well, again, as I said earlier, the WTO rules are extremely hard to figure out. I guess what I'm saying is that rather than complain about Chinese practices, which frankly are not going to change, they haven't so far, except, you know, to some degree their currency policies, let's just go ahead and do what we need to do in terms of supporting our own industries and trying to create jobs here, particularly if, you know, our economy starts to become more competitive, as we expect it will, with a depreciating dollar.
Okay, a lot of simplification, of course, in the ads that we are seeing one way and the other. However, real issues exist between the United States and China. We'll see what happens after the elections are over. Michael Hirsch, again, chief correspondent at the National Journal, author of Capital Offense, How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. Zachary Carabel, president of River Twice Research. His book, Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It. Also author of Sustainable Excellence, The Future of Business in the 21st Century. Harold Meyerson, a columnist for The Washington Post, editor-at-large for The American Prospect. David Chen, political reporter for The New York Times. Thanks, all of you, very much for being on our program today. After 69 days underground, 33 rescued miners are showing their signs of the ordeal. What does the incident itself say about Chile? We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. 33 miners, 69 days underground in China. In Chile. They're beginning to show emotional and psychological trauma, the effect of all of that. Intense media attention, though, is now being added to that. One miner told one newspaper, "I've had nightmares these days, but the worst nightmare of all is you." Charles Crowell is no longer near the mine. He's now in Santiago. He's Los Angeles Times special correspondent who did cover the incident at Copiapo for many days. And, Chris, good to have you back on our program. Tell us, if you will, about the miners. What's going on now, and what your general feeling is about China? You had you reported yesterday a rather different attitude toward Chile now, a different image than you had before.
Well, I think it was a remarkable accomplishment that they pulled off. I'm not sure all other Latin American countries could have done it. I think it bespeaks a certain openness here in Chile that. They reached out to other countries for help. They took it from the States, from Germany, from Australia. They took whatever expertise and equipment they could get. There's a sort of a pride in some countries here, countries that will go unnamed, that would rather try to do things themselves as a matter of pride. But the Chileans, I think they're a bit more more open, and I think the fact that they pulled this off. Is evidence of it.
Given their recent history, the demise of the Pinochet regime and what went on during those years, do you think that Chile has changed in important ways?
Oh, I think so. I think the country has they have free trade agreements with, I think it's 80 countries now. They've become sort of the Phoenicians of the 21st century. They're real traders. Super wealthy in natural resources, and they do everything they can to shop those resources around the world. And pretty progressive politics. The poverty level is low here, relatively speaking. They were the first South American country to be invited to the OECD, which is an association of the wealthier countries in the world. So I think the country is on the march.
On the other hand, the lives of the miners, it would seem, are not so good. They are returning to homes that are certainly destitute and by anybody's measure.
Well, I think things are going to get a lot better for them. I think we may be overplaying the deleterious effects of having to deal with the media. There's no doubt they're all going to benefit materially. Obviously, they went through a horrible trauma.
Well, those 33 will, but what about the others and the many that live in conditions of relative poverty?
Sure. Although miners make more money than blue-collar workers do in other parts of the economy. That's why there's this migration of sorts going on because of the price spike in commodities worldwide. Mining is undergoing a real boom period right now, and there are a lot of jobs being created, a lot of investment pouring in. So although by our standards, by U.S. standards, miners are poor, they make a lot more than non-technical, relatively uneducated workers do in the rest of the Chilean economy.
Back to the 33 miners themselves, they've agreed to share their story collectively in order to equally distribute whatever revenue they can get. Are they going to be able to hold that, do you think, hold to that?
Well, there's signs of cracks in that facade already, but I think they will. I think there's a lot of benefit to be had if they can maintain it, and so I think for the most part they will. It's my expectation. I could be wrong. Individuals may sign their own deals, but I suspect they're going to maintain this solidarity because their bargaining power will be much, much stronger.
If they do that, what would be the mechanics? Has anybody heard of people doing that before? What do you do? Get together, hire a single writer and have that person talk to everybody and work out a narrative from it?
Well, one of the 33, Omar Regales, was informally named, if not the business manager, in charge of finding a business manager, finding an attorney. And so I imagine I've got a lot of applicants. But once an attorney is found, then I would think they'll start negotiating some deals. And I don't think we'll be waiting that long.
Do you think you and the Los Angeles Times will be in the bidding?
No. No, I was up in Copiapó for 2 weeks, and for the moment, that's enough.
What about the, very quickly, we don't just have a few seconds left, but what do we know about the problems that they have been encountering since they got out, if you can be very brief about it?
The health minister mentioned that some of the men seem to be still disoriented, and it's given the exhaustion that they experienced during the time down there. As one psychologist put it, when you're exhausted, you have super high sensitivities and almost no tolerance. And all of us have been in that kind of condition at one point, at one time or another. So I think it's a matter of them taking a few days off, trying to find some rest if they can, get away from the media. And then things are going to be okay for them.
Okay, then they'll talk to that attorney and hopefully to a writer as well. Charles Crowell in Santiago for the L.A. Times. Thanks a lot for being with us. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of ACRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.